Hey, Mike here. I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to Dark Poutine early and ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime. You're about to listen to a historical episode of Dark Poutine. After episode 149, you will find Scott is no longer with the show. In an effort to maintain continuity and offer listeners as many episodes as possible, we are leaving the episodes in which he co-hosted intact. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Jamie from the Murderish podcast. You're listening to Dark Poutine, a podcast about Canada's creepier side with hosts Mike Brown and Scott Hemenway.
That was Jamie Rice, our good friend from the Murderish podcast, doing this week's intro. I did one for her too, which is kind of fun. She actually inspired me to tell my story by taking the time to talk about an event that happened to her in episode 4 of the Murderish podcast called A Stranger in My Bedroom. Hmm. Yeah. Have a listen to that. It's quite harrowing. It was her courageous matter-of-fact telling of that story that prompted me to finally tell my own story. So I've been planning this for a while, but this is a very special episode of Dark Poutine. I'm Mike Brown, creator and host of Dark Poutine. With me is my good friend Scott, co-host, sound engineer, and fellow broken-brained person. Say hello, Scott.
I'm Scooters.
You are Scooters. Scooters Hemenway. Maybe that's what we should call you on the podcast, is Scooter.
Maybe I shouldn't have mentioned that.
Okay, Scott, I won't call you Scooter.
All right, Matt.
Oh, that's so funny. So we've got, I essentially don't have to ask for intros anymore because so many people have sent us some.
That's awesome.
It is really great. Yeah.
Love everybody being involved.
Yeah, we appreciate anybody taking the time to do anything for us and with us. Back scratches would be nice, but I don't think you can send that via email.
Boo.
Right? We've had so many people send us story ideas. One in particular was a story about this girl who went missing. I don't know if you remember this one, Mindy Tran.
Oh, that sounds so familiar.
Yeah, she was a little girl who went missing riding her bike in the interior. And anyway, I ended up getting a lot of research about this little girl and what happened to her.
It sounds so familiar. It's coming to me as we are sitting here. Yeah.
Well, anyway, don't dig in too much because we will definitely talk about it in next week's episode. Mm. But this week, I'm telling my story. It's about time. So Scott's going to sign off here, but he'll be back at the end of the episode and we'll talk about, what I talk about.
Yeah.
So this one I'm doing solo. So let's get to it. Dark Poutine is not for the faint of heart or squeamish, as our content contains mature themes, harsh language, and graphic personal descriptions of a crime that happened to me. As always, listener discretion is advised, and maybe even a sense of humor. I don't know how funny anyone will find this one. I hope you don't. So put on your toque, grab yourself a double-double in an Nanaimo bar. It's time to scarf down some dark poutine. No Air Canada horns, not this week. I want to be careful how I present this story because it's mine. People have asked why I study the dark side of human nature or what Carl Jung refers to as the shadow. They've also asked, why true crime? Well, I'm going to tell you. I didn't have to do a lot of writing about this episode. I didn't have to do any research because I lived it. The events I'll be relating to you are extremely personal and not something I've ever talked about easily. I'm hoping I can tell it the right way. I want to let our listeners behind the curtain a bit to let you get to know a bit more about me. I'm a little fearful about doing this episode as well. I'm afraid I might get some negative backlash for talking about my story. I don't want to compare myself in any way to the horrible things some people have endured at the hands of criminals like the one I met. There's been a lot of that in the news lately. That's not what this is about. But the courage of others coming forward has definitely inspired me. I'm not looking for pity, sympathy, or even empathy. what my intent is to tell a story that I kept a secret for a big portion of my life. This is one of the deep, dark secrets that I held on to that made me terribly sick, mentally, physically, spiritually, emotionally, you name it. I was one sick puppy, and I needed help. Eventually, I got it, but it took a lot longer than it should have. I hope my candor inspires someone to relieve themselves of their own burden, so they don't have to suffer in silence for as long as I did. The story is relevant to the conversation of true crime, and it needs to be told, and it's not the only one I have, strangely. This is the one I'm telling you this time. Maybe my story will help someone feel less alone. They might hear it and be able to step out of the shadows and share their burden with someone else. That said, I can feel my chest tightening up as I write and speak, but forge ahead we must. I need to get this one out. This is the story of a crime that happened to an 11-year-old future podcast host one warm summer night way back when. A word of caution to you all. If you're triggered by or disturbed by discussions of sexual assault and violence, this may not be the episode for you. You've been warned. Anyway, here goes. Wednesday, July 29th, 1981 was a memorable one for a few reasons. I don't remember the whole day, but parts of it are burned into my brain. My 12th birthday was a week away, and the start of junior high was looming a month later. No more elementary school for this guy. I was going into grade 7, joining the big kids in BHS. Music has always been a big part of my life, so I tend to remember eras by the songs that people were listening to and that I was listening to. That week, Rick Springfield's song, Jesse's Girl, was number one, and Rick James' Super Freak had just been released. It wasn't even on the charts yet. I woke up early that morning. I don't recall if it was on purpose or not, but I think it was. It was the day Prince Charles married the media darling Lady Diana Spencer, who later became known as simply Princess Di. The time difference between the UK, specifically London, and Atlantic Canada is 4 hours. We had no VCR yet. PVRs didn't exist, so if you wanted to see a moment on TV, you had to either watch it live or wait for a replay. I chose watching live. I guess I was a bit of a royal fanboy, I don't know. The crowd watching in England and around the world had no idea what was in store for the young royal newlyweds, nor of Diana's ultimate sad end years later. I personally had no idea how my day was going to end. For years after, I thought if I'd known what was going to take place that day, I might not have left the house. I blame myself mercilessly for what happened, as some people do when bad things happen to them. I'm not saying it's the right thing to do, but it's what I did. The next order of business was going to receive my prize for having raised the most money for the Terry Fox Run-a-thon. It was the very first one. Terry Fox was a Canadian cancer survivor who had lost his leg to the disease. To raise awareness and money for cancer research, Terry Fox attempted to run across Canada alone on his remaining leg, doing a distinctive hop with his artificial right leg. He started his Marathon of Hope in Newfoundland in 1980, but only made it to Thunder Bay, Ontario, not halfway across the country. The cancer had come back and spread to his lungs. Terry died, but the Terry Fox Fun Run was created in his honor. The run still happens, and loads of cash is raised each year in Terry's name. I don't remember how much money I raised, but I assume it was a lot, as I won a prize. I got dressed in a white t-shirt, white sports socks, blue jeans, and white canvas Nike high tops. I also wore my red pullover windbreaker. It was one of those ones that would fold up into a pouch that went around your waist with an elastic belt. Me and three of my buddies all had exactly the same windbreaker. We were the furthest thing from a gang, though, just kids liked each other and liked to hang out a lot. It was the last day I wore that windbreaker that I'd begged my mom for. I was to go to the Desbrosiers Museum that sat in the park abutting my parents' property. I mentioned it in the Carissa Boudreau episode. I jogged up through the woods to the museum to have my photo taken for the local newspaper. At that time, it was called the Bridgewater Bulletin, while holding my prize, a dark blue and neon green trimmed Adidas book bag. Everybody remembers those who was alive in the 80s. Pretty much every young man had one. I was pretty proud of that bag. I already had an Adidas bag. I had a red and blue one, but I loved the colors of this one as the neon really stood out. Sadly, it would come to remind me of this shitty thing that happened to me. In the evening, I headed up to the Michelin Social Club on the other side of town to meet my buddies. My friend Barry's dad worked at Michelin, the tire plant, so we were allowed access to the social club to play floor hockey. Nothing organized, just a bunch of guys blowing off steam. As far as I remember, we had a pretty good time and finished around 9:30 p.m. We were there for most of the evening. The social club is about a 45-minute walk, 3.5 kilometers from my parents' house, literally on the other side of our small town. I started walking home with two of the other guys, Dominic and Barry. And Barry lived on St. Philip Street, so we left him first at his door. My pal Dominic lived near my dad's animal hospital, which is just over a kilometer away from home, or about another 20-minute walk. I was used to walking that route on my own. Not typically that late at night. I did at one point before we left consider calling Mom and Dad, but you know what? What the heck? It was only a little walk. I remember passing my grandmother's house. It was on the way. Her lights were still on. A block from Nanny's place was one of the only set of traffic lights that was in our hometown, where York Street turns into Alexander Avenue and is split by Dufferin Street. I could hear the sounds from the midway of the exhibition called the Big X in the exhibition grounds at the top of Dufferin Street, about a kilometer and a half away. I looked to my right, up Dufferin Street, as I crossed at the lights. I don't recall any traffic or cars at all. Most of the town, other than those whooping it up at the beer garden at the Big X, were most likely in bed. But I did see a lone man walking down the hill toward me. It was a small, safe town. I'd made this walk so many times. But something seemed off pretty much right away. My spidey sense was tingling. I looked behind me, and I could see about 50 meters back, the man who I had seen walking down the hill was starting to walk behind me. And he was walking quickly. I picked up the pace, being shorter of stature. Still, I had to move along at a good clip to stay ahead of the guy who seemed to be walking faster, as I did. Another couple blocks. He was getting closer. I could actually hear his footsteps and see his shadow stretched in the streetlights behind me. I definitely now believed something was wrong, but I tried to dismiss it as being all in my head. I had to get the advantage, though. I stopped right under a street lamp and bent down to tie my shoe. It didn't need tying, but I tied it anyway. My bum was to the stranger. I didn't want to make eye contact. He walked by me really slowly, but he went. I could feel him staring at me as he passed. I don't know if you've ever felt that, but that's the way it felt. I was thoroughly creeped out by that time. Having him in front of me, I walked much slower to put some distance between myself and the man. In 250 meters, I'd be at home. Just a couple blocks, but first we had to walk by that damn park. It was really, really dark in there. I didn't want that guy anywhere near me in the darkness, especially in that park. That would not be good. This guy oozed creep. I'm not sure how I knew, but I knew. I'd never had a bad experience with any adult in my life that I could recall before that, not once. The man turned down Park Street. It's a very short street. There were only 5 houses on the street, and it's a dead end. Being from that neighborhood, I knew everybody who lived on that street, and that guy did not belong there. He was out of place. As I approached Park Street myself, I picked up the pace again, hoping that I could get by without having to have a confrontation with this guy. But he turned on his heel and he came toward me, quickly, illuminated by only a streetlight on the other side of the road. It was pretty terrifying. He wasn't a big man, but bigger than me. It doesn't take much to be taller than I am. He was wearing dark brown slacks, a white collared shirt, and a brown blazer with beige patches on the elbows. He had hush puppy shoes on, like my dad wore. He had to be somewhere in his early to mid-30s. His hair looked like a helmet. I don't know why I remember that, but it was a weird hairdo, some kind of shitty comb-over, and he had really dark eyes. He spoke to me as he walked toward me. He said, "Do you have the time?" I said, stopping, "No, but I think it's around 10:30. Almost right on top of me, he said, "Don't you think it's a little late for a boy your age to be out?" I think I said no. I don't really recall, although a lot of the rest of it I remember very vividly. I don't really remember what I said or did, which is really weird. Perhaps that's something that happens in a traumatic event. It was then that he grabbed me hard. He quickly bent my arm back up behind my back, my right arm. I was so startled, I don't even remember if it hurt or not. He growled into my ear, "Don't scream or I'll break your arm." He smelled funny, too, like alcohol, shitty food, BO, or all three. I don't know. He started pushing me quickly toward the dark woods of the park. I was horrified, but I was going. I didn't know whether I should scream or not. You know, he'd threatened me. I didn't understand what was happening at all, and I really, truly began to fear for my life. He was hurting me. I was crying. I whimpered, "What are you going to do to me?" Little did I know then, but with the answer to that question, my innocence would end right there. In that moment, my childhood was effectively over. He said to me, "I'm going to take you into the woods and I'm going to suck your cock." I'm sorry if those words offend you, but those are the words that he said to me. He said those words to an 11-year-old boy. Sure, I'd seen pornography before, but I didn't understand it or what it really was. We hadn't had the talk. I was 11. I'd never had any kind of sexual relationship. I was painfully shy. I had never even held a girl's hand. All I could think about was that this could not happen and that I had to get away. So, adrenaline, I don't know. I screamed and I squirmed as hard as I could. I don't know whether I hurt myself or him or what, but I just broke out of his iron grip and I took off. And I ran. It's amazing what strength some adrenaline will give you. I ran for the first house that I could see. It was the Krause's house. I knew their son, Danny, not well. He was younger than me, but I remember him. We used to toboggan together on the hill that I'd just been attacked on. His father opened the door. He looked kind of disheveled and tired. The lights hadn't been on in the house until I began pounding and screaming. I guess they were in bed. Mr. Krause invited me inside as I blubbered and went on. Like I say, I can't remember what I said. I really don't. All I remember is I was horrified. I just remember the feelings. Mr. Krause called my dad, and he called the police. The police got there first. Dad was angry that the police had gone ahead and questioned me about what was going on prior to his getting there, but that was understandable. Something bad had happened to his son. Me and my dad and the police officer all got into the town of Bridgewater squad car and went looking along the route that I had walked and the route where I had seen the man up Dufferin Street. There was no sign of him. He was long gone. I also remember that night the police setting the tone for how I was to think of this situation in the future, saying things like, well, it could have been worse. And even if we were to catch him, it would be your word against his. I mean, it was 1981, I guess. The most horrific thing that I had been through in my short life had now been minimized by those two sentiments. I tried to push the thoughts of what happened to me as far away as I possibly could. Obviously, I didn't sleep well that night or for a few nights after that. I remember going to see our minister, Sandy McLean, and he talking to me about what had gone on. And I don't remember what we talked about, but I don't think it helped very much. Over the next few weeks, though, Clifford Olson was arrested for and eventually convicted of the murders of 11 children around my age here in British Columbia, 4,300 miles away. I had to see a photo of him. Was he the guy? I absolutely thought that it could be. No, after seeing the photo, I knew it wasn't him, but I got to relive my own horrors as I listened to those of what had gone on here in British Columbia. I never wore my red windbreaker again. I shoved it as far back as I could in the space above the coat closet. I'm sure Mom found it years later and wondered what the heck it was doing there. I wanted every reminder of that night to be as far away from me as I possibly could. Out of sight, out of mind, right? Wrong. I wasn't getting away that easy. The thought of what happened played over and over and over again with me. What I now know as PTSD. I became a very angry person. I didn't want to hang out with people anymore. I was embarrassed. The friends that I had from that time, I started to drift away from, and I even fought physically with a couple of them. The thoughts of that man and what he did to me haunted me. I even secretly thought that having a man want me in that way meant I was gay. But I was never attracted to men in that way. But I had a lot of confusion in my 11-year-old brain. I wasn't prepared to deal with that. I dealt with the police twice more that summer, once to give a more detailed description of the man to a sketch artist, and another time to look at a suspect through one-way glass. I'll elaborate more on that in my conversation with Scott later on. I did see this man a few times around town and much later found out his name, but I somehow felt unworthy of resolution. Hey, it could have been worse, right? It was his word against mine. In my head, I was making too much of a thing of it, and I didn't think anybody wanted to talk to me about it. I was just going to keep it a secret. I didn't want to bug anyone. I believed I deserved what happened to me. I shouldn't have been out that late. I could have called for a ride home. Why the hell didn't I call for a ride home? Mom and Dad always said, just call. But I didn't. It could have been much worse. Yes, it could have been. On and on it goes. Where it stops, nobody knows. When we talk to Scott later on, I'll talk more about what the aftermath of this was and my run-ins with this guy, even after the fact. That's the story of what happened to me on July 29th, 1981. Yeah, maybe it doesn't seem like a lot to you, but it certainly seemed like a lot to me. And until I actually got the help that I required, I didn't get to feel any better about it. This story is a big part of why I have an interest in true crime and what makes a criminal tick. I want to know, what does it take to make a monster? I know Mike in Sword and Scale talks about that monsters are real. And I believe it's true. I've met one. Have you? I really hope you haven't. But if you have, tell somebody. Have a conversation. Don't hold it inside. You really need to get that out. And I'm not telling you to get it out to me. Get it out to a professional. I'm just some Yahoo who has a podcast who may have had an experience similar to yours. It's best if you talk to the police or a doctor or somebody you trust. Anyway, let's talk to Scott. Yeah, so that's my story. So, I mean, I was 11 years old.
Mm.
You know, and I don't know. A lot more serious things have happened to other people, and I know people who have not escaped an attacker. So part of me even feels guilty for feeling bad about it.
Well, there's no trauma elitism.
I didn't ask to feel bad about it. Yeah.
It's about how it impacts you.
Yeah.
That's what a trauma is about, is how something has impacted you. And to you, that was the most serious thing you had ever been through at that time.
Yep.
And so it's going to be as jarring and is as impactful as the scariest thing happening to somebody else at a particular time in their life. You can't sit there and say my trauma is more serious than yours or vice versa. It's legitimate, and it was a traumatizing event.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and you know, there was a lot of those different features that were there that may have added to things, like the fact that it happened on the day that Charles and Diana got married. So every time that came up, I had a week before my birthday to remember this guy had attacked me,
mm-hmm.
you know, and.
Well, we tend to as well. One of the things I learned in therapy is that one way you can tell that an event was traumatic because you remember it vividly. You remember all the details. You can remember very silly things from earlier in the day to later that night. Like that's one way to be able to ascertain, was it a trauma or not? Is I can remember in therapy just opening up to my therapist. And it was an event that I actually didn't really consider traumatizing, but I remember the therapist saying, like, hearing you retell that story, like that was a traumatic event because you're telling me every minute detail.
Yeah. Yeah. And the fact that at the exact same time, Clifford Olson was doing his thing here in BC, and that was all over the news. And, you know, I was obsessed with seeing a picture of Clifford Olson because I thought I was 4,300 miles away. So there is not a lot of chance that it was actually him. But at the same time, my little pea brain was just, you know, obsessed with, like, was this the guy who tried to hurt me?
Yeah, for sure. Well, at 11 years old, you don't know how to react. You don't know how to process things. You're not going to be thinking cognitively at 11 years old.
I'm still
he's on the other side of the continent.
Yeah,
it wasn't him.
Yeah,
you're thinking in a sense of a man is grabbing kids essentially and killing them, and you just had a man grab you. And so you're going to draw those parallels.
Sure. Yeah, for sure. So after this happened to me, obviously the police want me to have a look at one of the local folks who may or may not have been the person who was the perpetrator of the crime. So they dragged me in to look through one-way glass and it wasn't the guy.
Mm-hmm.
But the police messed up. They brought him out into the lobby of the police station at the same time as they brought me out.
Oh, jeez.
So this guy sees this little kid who may or may not be accusing him of something that he didn't do.
Yep.
You know? And he looks right at me and he says, I didn't touch that fucking little bastard. I didn't touch that little prick. You know, so thank you, police department, for traumatizing me again.
What an error.
Yeah, not good.
No.
So that was the only time that I ever saw anybody as far as cops go after that.
Yeah.
I later had instances with the police. But
unrelated.
You know what? And unrelated to this. Well, maybe it was, you know.
Yeah.
But I was in a lot of pain for a lot of years, right? Yeah.
That's why I kind of, you know, said maybe not, because the impact of the trauma.
Yeah, for sure.
Impacts future decisions.
Right. But so the word of the day back then was like, just get over it.
Yeah.
Just get over it. It's okay. It could have been worse.
Yeah.
It could have been worse. It could have been so much worse. And yeah, it could have been. It absolutely could have been. But I also learned about... fight, flight, and there's another thing, freeze.
Yep.
That is something that I beat myself for years about. So what happened was I saw this guy driving by slowly in his car looking at me.
Mm-hmm.
The thing was, after I had had my picture in the newspaper with my full name, Michael Brown, Brown with an E, there's only one or two families with Brown with an E in that town.
Yep.
And the way the world worked at that time was our name was in the phone book.
Yep.
So this person would know who my parents were, where I lived. He would know our phone number. He would know exactly who I was, because we were on the street that I lived on when he did this to me, you know? So there's no way he didn't know who I was if he saw that, that Bridgewater Bulletin newspaper the next week.
Yeah.
I was wearing the clothes that I was wearing when he grabbed me.
Jesus. Wow.
Yeah. So yeah, when I saw him again, I froze. I couldn't tell anybody. There was something in me that was just like, I just was so in denial, so frozen by it. It was just like, nope, you know, there's no, I can't deal with this.
Yeah. I understand that. Yeah.
Yeah. Another time I saw him driving by at the school. So going slowly past the playground, like any good pedophile would probably do in his car, drive slowly past the kids.
Yep.
And there I was. And we made eye contact again.
Oh, man.
Interestingly, my friend Dominic, his dad was the chef at a local restaurant called Gentleman Jim's, and it was excellent food. And sometimes, and it was in the mall, in the Bridgewater Mall, just down the street from the school. So sometimes Dominic and I would go to Gentleman Jim's for lunch. His dad would make us lunch in the back.
Awesome.
And they had like Asteroids and Pac-Man to play and those kind of things out in the bar area. Mm-hmm. And we could just go do that. But one time we went in through the back way in Gentleman Jim's, and we were going to go out and play some video games, and walked out, and who should be sitting in the restaurant having lunch but this guy?
Oh, fuck.
Right. And again, once again, I froze. I was embarrassed.
Yeah.
I was questioning, you know, I was questioning by that time, my 12-year-old sexuality was in question because I didn't want people to know that another man had wanted me, quote unquote, sexually.
Yep.
And it's not sex. It's a power thing. Mm-hmm. It's this creep doing something creepy to a little kid who is defenseless. I'm not a big person still today. I'm a heavier person, but I'm not a tall person. And then I was a very slight little kid.
Yeah.
You know? So I saw him and I said to Dominic, I said, I don't feel like playing today. And I think I'm going to probably head out. And he and his dad didn't know what to do. Like, what's wrong? I didn't tell them.
Yeah.
I couldn't.
Yeah.
Because then they would know that I had this secret, right? That I had this thing that had happened to me. And Dominic was one of the kids who was with me at the social club that night. So, you know, it was just like I had lie after lie after lie I was telling. And I began to just really, really hate myself. And that's when, I don't know, like I was thinking about dying as a kid, you know, like I've told this story a few times to different people, not on this podcast, but I was suicidal when I was 11 years old. So I wanted to die. I didn't tell my parents that, you know, I wanted that, although they knew I was upset and sad, but I didn't ever take any action on that. But I don't know, when I was 13 or 14, I found booze, and that was kind of like a bit of solace from this whole thing for a few years anyway.
Yeah.
Until that turned on me eventually.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's part of what I drank at was that.
It was a coping mechanism.
Sure. There was other stuff. I mean, I'm adopted. I had issues around that and all that kind of stuff. But this is one that would always crop up. I came home drunk one time and I was crying to mom about this man. And this was years later, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it would come out at inopportune times. I would be miserable about it, and I wanted to talk about it, but I didn't know how.
Yeah.
I didn't know what to say. And I wanted to be past it, but I couldn't.
Yeah.
So there was a couple other instances of me seeing him. I saw him. I have vague recollections of seeing him when I was very drunk at McDonald's one night. And by that time, I was into martial arts. Mm-hmm. This is part of why I got into martial arts, too, because I wanted to be able to take care of myself. I became, in my drunken days, not a nice person to be around, mm-hmm. which is a big part of why I don't drink anymore. It's very foggy. So I don't know if even what I'm telling you is true, because I was just so out of it. But I remember seeing this guy and saying, that's the guy. And I had told my buddy Mike, who's since passed away, you know, in confidence one night when I was drunk, I spilled it to him, you know, like you do when you're drunk. You just talk about dumb shit or stuff that's really heavy and bothers you. And so I told my buddy Mike, and I said, that's him. I'm going to fucking kill him. And I remember like a couple of my buddies, and I can't remember who, but I know Mike was there. And I remember them holding me back and just saying it's not worth it.
Mm.
So, but yeah, that's a very foggy thing. That could have been a dream or a hallucination or what, because there's a lot of foggy parts of my life because of that stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I was a drunk. You know, that's the way I coped with this stuff.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people do.
Yep. And so, I mean, this is part of why I want to talk about it, because it doesn't help you to avoid dealing with your stuff. It doesn't help anybody keeping it inside. I really wish I could have done better. I don't know if this guy ever hurt anybody else. I don't know that for sure, but I would assume that he had.
In all likelihood, yes.
Yeah. And part of me also felt guilty that I couldn't address that.
Yeah.
You know, is that my fault?
No.
Right? Exactly. I know it's not today, but that thought has carried with me for years and years. If he touched somebody else and I hadn't been able to identify him or deal with him, because I never knew his name, he just would show up.
Yeah.
And what am I going to do? Call the cops? And like, I didn't understand it.
Yeah. I still live with that. Yeah.
I did end up finding out his name.
Oh, you did?
I did.
Oh, wow.
So I don't want to say her name because it's up to her to tell her story.
Yeah.
But a girlfriend who I had before I moved out here to BC, she had been molested by her uncle from the time she was 2 until she was 16.
Oh.
Like horrific. Like I can't imagine like somebody... Yeah, I don't even want to go there, but that's what happened. So she and I, I had told her my story and she had shared hers with me. So we had some common ground there. We were both pretty sick puppies at the time. I was newly sober. You know, I had finally found sobriety. I was trying to do what I needed to do to stay sober. And, we were at her grandma's place one night and we're going through, their photo albums, and there in her grandmother's photo album was this guy.
Oh my God.
Right in the photo album. Yeah. And I was like, oh my God, who's that? And she told me his name. And I said, that's the guy that did that to me. And she looked at me and said, the guy with him is my uncle who did it to me.
God.
So, birds of a feather, you know?
Yeah.
And her uncle had been in jail, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, for what happened to her. Horrific. She was a very, very mixed up person. And she had to be to get together with somebody who was as mixed up as I was at the time.
Yeah.
Obviously, we're not together now. We parted ways when I moved out here. So I carried that with me for a while. Mm. Like, okay, now I know this guy's name. And a few years ago, it was just eating at me. I think I was still working in the movie business at the time. So I picked up the phone and I called the RCMP.
Hmm.
I talked to some people about it previous and they said, yeah, go ahead. It's probably a good idea for you to call. Even if it just gets it out for yourself. So I did. I called the RCMP and I said, a guy touched me when I was a kid and I know this person's name. I want to talk about it. And they were like, okay. Like they took me very seriously, the RCMP here in Burnaby. Mm. So I went to the office in Burnaby and I was interviewed in one of those interview rooms like you see on all the TV shows.
Like I was in this morning.
Like, oh yeah, we don't want to talk about
it. No.
Anyway, that's for another podcast. And no, Scott is not a suspect.
No.
So they interviewed me about, and I told my story. I told the story the way I told it here.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to contact your hometown and we're gonna have a detective from Bridgewater give you a call. Okay, fair enough. Great. Fantastic. Because I wanted to close the door on this.
Mm-hmm.
So the Bridgewater police did their thing and gave me a call and they had a photo lineup that I had to do. And so they emailed me pictures and I was supposed to open each one, look at it, say whether or not it was him and delete it. I wasn't supposed to keep these on my computer in any way. I would apparently be breaking the law if I did.
Mm.
So, okay, fair enough. So they emailed me one. I looked, this guy's pretty creepy. I said, no, that's not him. And I couldn't really see the guy in there. But what I realized later was, yes, this person was there, but it was a picture of him
now. Yeah.
So I didn't recognize him. I later on, so I had conversation with the cop and I said, I can't for sure 100% say who's who. I don't know if it's this guy. And the cop's like, well, you know, he was in there. The person that you named was in there. And I thought about it like months later, like a month later, it came to me the exact picture. Mm. Like now I see it when I close my eyes, I see that picture.
Yeah.
So I know what he looks like now too. But I said, and I had to ask them, I said, has he hurt anybody else? And they said, well, we can't tell you that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But what we can tell you is that we know who he is.
Fuck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Sorry. Give your kids a hug, you know, and tell them that it's okay to talk about stuff. If they need to talk to you, like, always let them know, hey, I'm here for you. I want to hear what you have to tell me, no matter how bad you think it is. So, I don't know. That's kind of as much as I want to talk about with that.
That's understandable.
Yeah. So.
Oh, fuck.
Yeah, the aftermath of it obviously has been a little rough, and I'm going to give some phone numbers for people to call, some helplines and stuff like
yeah.
that here in a bit.
And just hearing you talk about calling the police so later in life, it does make me inclined to perhaps do the same.
Huh.
Although I don't know the person's name. I know what he called himself from my childhood and stuff. But that always kind of kept me because it's like, well, what am I going to say? Like some guy who lived in
But here's the
Vancouver
thing.
At some time.
Yeah, exactly. But here's the thing. So I listened to a podcast with Jim Clemente. I've mentioned him to you. He was the former FBI profiler. Mm. He was a prosecutor.
Yeah.
And he was also molested as a kid. He said the average is like 20 years. That people will go for 20 years and not
really,
report.
Really, yeah?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
This is very
common for somebody who's our age to be wanting to talk, or just a little younger, to want to talk about it.
Wow, that's interesting.
It is.
Yeah. So, I mean, as you've talked about and as you mentioned earlier, a lot of it resonates in regards to not knowing how you feel about yourself, what's right and what's wrong, am I the bad guy? Was that a lot of that just creates silence,
right?
It creates silence, and so like a lot of us will just keep it quiet because of who knows, perhaps more violence if you talk about it. Maybe somebody maybe the person will come and hurt you. Maybe. You get embarrassed. Maybe people will blame you. There are so many reasons, but it's very, very easy to bottle it up.
Yep. Well, it's not healthy. I am living proof that it's not.
Yeah. Yes, you are.
Yeah. but I'm also living proof that, you know, stepping out into the sunshine is the best thing for your soul.
Yeah.
Like seriously, honestly, I am glad that happened to me in a way today. Because I can share my experience with somebody else that maybe will help them to overcome their thing. Because I've been through the ringer. I've been through it. And I'm come out the other side now, and I'm able to talk about it in a way that I can share with a few people who listen to the podcast, right?
Yep.
But maybe one of them, I don't care if it's just one person. If it's one person that has to hear what I had to say, fantastic. I have done what I intended to do with this episode.
And there's something very cathartic as well about publicly getting that off your chest, publicly speaking it, because there's no hiding from it after that. It's out there.
Yeah.
It's out there. Yeah. So there's you have to accept it at that point. And I found a very empowering feeling about just getting it out there. It's like, okay, I don't have to hide this anymore.
No.
I don't have to hide this.
No. And it's like, so when I watched, and I don't want to co-opt another movement or anything like that, a movement, but I watched what's happened recently with the people in Hollywood and the whole Me Too thing. And I thought, you know, again, I went into minimizing what happened to me because some of the stuff that happened to those people was horrific.
Yeah.
Horrific. But at the same time, you know, minimizing doesn't help anybody.
No, and it's not about comparing traumas.
Yeah.
To each individual, yep. Your trauma is your trauma.
Yep.
And it's valid and it's legitimate and it's real.
Yeah.
And so again, a lot of what you're saying, so many parallels ring true with me. But yeah, it's not about which trauma is more important or serious than the other.
Right.
It happened.
Yeah.
And it impacted you.
Yep.
And it's guided a lot of decision making in your life.
Oh, for sure.
You know, and so it's it's. Thank you for sharing.
Thank you. So that's it for this episode. So uplifting, this one. If you'd like to learn more about this and other episodes of Dark Poutine, check out our website, www.darkpoutine.com. If you have any story ideas, questions, comments, or just want to say hi, lots of people have, you can reach us via email at darkpoutinepodcast@gmail.com. Please follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And tell your friends about us. Lots of you have done that too, and we really appreciate it. Please subscribe to us on your favorite podcast directory. And if you feel so inclined, please leave a 5-star review on iTunes. And I found out this week that if someone leaves a 5-star review for us on the American iTunes, I don't see it on the Canadian one, nor do I see it on the UK one. So lots of people have left us reviews and have been so kind and nice, and we haven't seen them because I'm a dum-dum. But anyway, so now I know how to do it. So some other people have shown me the way.
Yeah, it's interesting because I had somebody reach out to me and be like, hey, have you seen my review? I don't know if it posted or not. Yeah. And I was like, I don't see it, but I guess I was on the...
That's exactly why.
Yeah.
Yep. So anyway, so that's it. You know what? Every little bit helps us, so we appreciate it.
Yeah.
Don't forget to be a good egg and not a bad apple, like the one I talked about tonight.
Don't be like him.
No.
Bye-bye.